Well, I told Don before we started that I think what's happening today is more important than what happened a long time ago, but tomorrow is the 62nd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and there's a lot of interest in it once a year. So I'm glad that I can talk about a little background to the attack, and then the attack itself, and then what my personal experiences were and what I did during that time. And I'm glad to see that Joe is here. Joe has a doctorate in history, and he's a real expert. So he and I occasionally get together and compare the historical facts of Pearl Harbor. And then back over here, Mike Clark. Glad you could make it. Mike and I get together for breakfast once a week when we can. So glad, Mike, glad you made it. Now, to give a little background, that the attack on Pearl Harbor, well, I got the wrong one first here. Japanese mythology tells us that the sun goddess Amaterasu and of an island empire ruled by her divine descendants and populated by her chosen people. So 2,400 years ago, a Japanese a goddess from whom all the rulers ascended, and they were all divine. Hirohito was the first one to renounce that he was just a human being. But she looked ahead. She saw a day coming when the island empire of her descendants would rule the world. So that's been their belief for a long time. It was at this point, more than 2,400 years ago, that the path to Pearl Harbor began. This background helped push the Japanese into an assumption of a manifest destiny, which was the control of East Asia. And I copy this from an editorial in the Honolulu Star Bulletin. Now, it wasn't until 1895 that the Japanese began to get serious. In 1884 and 1885, they had a war with China, got Formosa in the peace terms. They replaced China as the dominating Korea international affairs. 1904 and 5, war with Russia, got the Russian islands north of Japan, and they also replaced Russia as the dominating force in Manchuria. 1910, they annexed Korea. 1917, defeated Germany in Shantung, got German islands north of the equator, the Marianas and Carolinas and so forth. And in 1927, the Prime Minister presented a document to the King, Hirohito, the Emperor, who approved it, and this was for a 100-year plan to conquer the world. I've got copies of this document. The historicity of it is sometimes disputed, but the fact that this was a plan is not disputed. So it was in three phases. The first phase was to capture Manchuria for manpower and raw material. The second phase was to capture what they call the Southern Resources Area. The three things they needed most to build a war machine and carry on war were rubber, tin, and oil. And Indonesia had all these, as well as Malaysia and Singapore, and having some rubber also. So their next objective, after securing Manchuria, was to conquer the Southern Resources Area. Then the third phase was to build up a war machine so that when the opportune time came, they would set out to conquer the world. So they continued their expansion very rapidly here. In 1931, annexed Manchuria and set up a puppet emperor. 1935-38, captured Peking and the major cities in southern China, Shanghai, Hankou, Canton. And in that campaign was what is called the Rape of Nanking. And it's estimated some place between the figures run all the way from 40,000 to 250,000 people were killed in that campaign. They set up the, where are we here? 1937, they sunk the American gunboat, USS Panay. And there's a lot of big headlines, a lot of talk, but nobody knew anything about it, did anything about it. So the Japanese assumed that we would not seriously oppose anything they were doing in that part of the world. In 1939, they seized Hainan Island. I had got some water on my slide here. Hainan Island has recently been in the news, and what was that? Do you remember?
Was the P-3 Orion was flying too close, and she collided with a Chinese fighter, which was forced down.
Yeah, that's where our fighter had landed, Hainan Island. They set up in 1940 the Wang government in China. So they were effectively in control of all of China. In 1940, they set up the Pact of Steel with Germany and Italy. And in their dream plans, I think they were never serious about this, but they were thinking that Germany would invade the U.S. through Canada and Japan through Mexico. That's found in their records of what they were going to do. In 1940, they resigned from the League of Nations. 1941, occupied Indochina. 1941, completed training and equipping a 200,000-man army in Taiwan with 800 aircraft and 94 troop transports. In July 41, President Roosevelt cut off oil exports to Britain and Indonesia, persuaded Britain and Indonesia to do the same. And now Malaysia and Indonesia were a must. Now, this is not big enough for you to see, but you can use your imagination a little bit. As you look on the coast here, this part of the world, this hemisphere, up here you've got Japan. Right below you've got Okinawa. Right below you've got Taiwan. Right below you've got the Philippines. And right below this, Indonesia. So there was one big barrier to them occupying the Southern Resources area, and that was the U.S. presence in the Philippines. They knew from captured intelligence that our plans for defending the Philippines, although these were probably obsolete, involved stationing the battleships in certain areas in the Philippines to defend against landing. Now, they had this task force all ready to go, 94 transports, 800 aircraft, 200,000 men to invade the Philippines. So their main purpose in coming to Pearl Harbor was to neutralize the battleships. They attacked all the aircraft installations so that they wouldn't be pursued back. Well, 1939, a treaty was canceled, in effect, since 1911, cutting off selling scrap iron by the U.S. In 1940, the fleet of which I was a part went to Pearl Harbor for summer maneuvers. We went out there once a year. So while we were out there, somebody from Washington sent word to the commander-in-chief that they wanted Pearl Harbor to be the permanent base for the Pacific Fleet. Now, the Pearl Harbor is a small harbor compared to some others, and we were so jammed up in there that there wasn't room for anything. Ships were tied up, four and five together. Battleships were in there by twos. Well, as things got warmer between the Japan and the U.S., on December 5th, Japan said, well, we don't want war. We want to iron out our differences, and we're going to send a special peace ambassador to iron out the differences. And I remember seeing him. I was part of the fleet that had been out on patrol on Friday afternoon. Admiral Caruso, the peace ambassador, flew in, landed at Pearl Harbor, stayed overnight. Well, in order to make it appear that we were peaceful, the president or one of his staff ordered the patrols all in. So the third of the fleet that had been on patrol was in the harbor. And so Caruso got a good view of the fleet there, sitting there, no aggressive intentions. That's what he was supposed to take back to Washington, back to Tokyo. However, when he took off Saturday morning, I watched the plane take off, and I hoped it'd be successful. But he knew that the Japanese fleet was just over the horizon. They're ready to attack. Now, Japan had done this same thing when they defeated Russia in 1945. So they have a history of attacking before they declare war. Well, as the I've got a picture of what the Japanese saw as they came in that morning. I got it. Yeah. So the Japanese attacked then on December 7th, arrived in Pearl Harbor about 7:55 Honolulu time. And the battleships were, California was up here, the Oklahoma and Maryland here, West Virginia and Tennessee here, the Arizona here, and the Nevada here. And the Pennsylvania was in dry dock over here, eight of the battleships. So some of them approached from this direction, some from this direction, but that's what the battleships look like. This is a Japanese picture here. As they came in that morning, this is also Japanese files. You note of the 40 torpedoes that they fired, nine of them were aimed at the USS West Virginia, which was my ship. Another nine were aimed at the Oklahoma right here. A couple of them at the California. And a few of them came from the other side, the ships that are on that side of Fort Island. And a few of them stuck in the mud here. But the Japanese kept track of what happened to all 40 torpedoes. They had over 100 high-level bombers. And I'm not sure just which of the raids this was, but you notice of about 50 bombs that were dropped, all these are misses. If I look at that picture, I can only find 2 out of 50 that hit. Now, had the bombs been accurate, there wouldn't have been much left to salvage on that, but fortunately, they misses. Then when the next wave of horizontal bombers came over, smoke from the Arizona formed a smoke screen, so they couldn't see their targets in that. So the next, second group of horizontal bombers did even worse. We don't have a record of them. This is what my ship, the West Virginia, looked like in good times. In those days, it only cost $42 million. So that was my home for 10 years, concluding with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Well, as the torpedoes came in, the bombs began to drop. Matt, do you want to hit this thing here? And I just got about a minute segment that was shown on Channel 13 a couple years ago here.
Even though it's 59 years ago, it's as fresh in my memory as if it were a year ago.
That's Pearl Harbor survivor Jim Downing.
We were 5 miles away. We heard the explosions, and the aircraft should explode in the backyard, 3 or 25 feet wide. So in the next 15 minutes, we were in the midst of it.
The bombing may have been 59 years ago, but don't think for a minute that today's servicemen and women have forgotten.
It's like when you see somebody who lived through Pearl Harbor, you say, well, thank you for being there, because you were there, now I'm here.
To also remember and appreciate the ones who died for our liberties.
And for those that survived, there's even a Pearl Harbor motto.
Remember Pearl Harbor, keep America strong, so that it won't happen again.
In the Pearl Harbor...
I looked for some better pictures. You know, that morning, we've got some good pictures that there was a life photographer visiting Honolulu at that time. And he set up early in the morning at sunrise up over the harbor just to get some shots. And he never realized what a strategic position he was in. So he photographed the entire attack for Life magazine. So most of the good pictures we have of the scenes are the ones that he took up there. Well, the West Virginia took 9 torpedoes, and this is also a Japanese picture, which is pretty accurate, of where they hit. 8 of them hit in this area, and the other hit and knocked the rudder off back here. This was the area that, you know, I would have been in if I'd have been aboard when the torpedoes hit there.
Where were you on that morning?
Big pardon?
Where were you on that morning?
I was having breakfast about 20 minutes away when the attack broke out. And I'll mention a little bit, you know, what I did as it came down there.
Jim, could you put that back just for a second? I want to make a comment.
Okay.
There's some research coming out now, and these people use these cameras and computers, and they digitize everything. Some of those torpedo hits, they're saying now, Japanese midget submarines had penetrated Pearl Harbor that morning. And there's one famous photograph of Pearl Harbor, I'm sure you've seen it, and they've tracked it. And you can see, they've blown the picture up, they've digitized it, and you can see what looks like the wake of two torpedoes coming from a midget submarine, maybe 200 yards off of West Virginia. And it's amazing that what they can do with computers and digital stuff. And this has been in the naval proceedings off and on now for a couple of years. They've been talking about it.
Good. And maybe they'll be able to construct a thing live one of these days then, huh? This is the picture that you see most often of Pearl Harbor. And this is the West Virginia after she hit the bottom here. I came aboard from Tennessee about the time that this picture was taken here.
How did you make it from the Tennessee to the West Virginia, considering the West Virginia was considerably lower than the Tennessee, having...
Okay, I'm glad you asked that. See, here's the Tennessee. Here's the Arizona going off. And we were leaning. Now, Pearl Harbor is not a deep harbor. Where the ships were moored there is about 40 feet. And a battleship fully loaded draws about 36 feet. So there's only 4 feet of water underneath. So, of course, it slants a little bit, so we're slanting. So I got on a 5-inch 51 caliber gun on a Tennessee and slid down the barrel. That's the way I got aboard that morning. In addition to hitting the ships, the Japanese didn't want any aircraft to pursue them, so they destroyed about 150 aircraft that were at the 7 other air bases on the island there. Wasn't long before they got our anti-aircraft guns in action, too late for the torpedo planes that came in undetected. I'm often asked, what do you think of the Pearl Harbor film? And I say, well, I'm glad that it was produced. It's very educational. I think well done, very entertaining. But there were 164 ships, including a Coast Guard and a small craft in the harbor that morning. And of the 164, 20 were damaged. 144 ships were totally untouched. And they went about doing what they're supposed to do. Well, the Pearl Harbor film doesn't show any of the orderly scenes. It's just the chaotic scenes. In fact, the battleship Tennessee, that we were moored alongside, fired every round of anti-aircraft ammunition she had on board there. This is the water coming in, and another picture. This is where the battleship row was over here. But Pearl Harbor wasn't the only thing that was going on that Sunday morning. They hit Indonesia actually 20 minutes before they struck Pearl Harbor. Malaysia, they attacked there at 10 a.m. And Shanghai at 10. I've tried to get these in order. Singapore at 11:30. Guam Island and Wake Island. And I mentioned Indonesia. So they had a lot more going that morning. other than Pearl Harbor. In fact, it was one of the minor skirmishes. The next day, they sunk the Prince of Wales, which was the main ship defending Singapore, and the cruiser defending that out there. So it was a well-coordinated attack. So we've just been married since July and had been out to sea most of the time since then. So my wife and I were looking forward to a long weekend. We had some guests for breakfast. Actually, the couple that ran the Navigator home there were away for the weekend, so we stood in for them, had eight other servicemen for breakfast. So we were sitting around the breakfast table when we heard the first explosions. We turned on the radio, and Webley Edwards, who owned the station there, they only had two radio stations then, said that we've been advised by the Army and Navy intelligence that the island of Oahu is under enemy attack. So we got in our uniforms, got in the car, turned on the radio, headed down the harbor, about six of us, and about halfway down, it was only 20 minutes down, why Webley Edwards came on and said that the enemy has been identified as Japan. So we knew what we were up against. All their planes were painted olive drab, just like the Army planes. So looking at them, I didn't realize, you know, I wasn't sure they were Japanese because they were painted exactly like the Army planes until got down to the landing here. By that time, so much oil had leaked out of the ships that had been hit, and it was burning on the water, that anybody that had a boat was out trying to pull sailors out of this fuel oil. It was burning there. So there wasn't any transportation from where we came down on the dock here to get back to the ship, or what was left of it. So I had to walk about a mile down here. Now in this...
Was that a pretty chaotic mile? What were you thinking and feeling at the time?
Okay, I'll tell you that now. If I want to find something here on this, let me get the bigger map here. See this spot right here? That's the Neosho. Neosho is a Colorado River. That particular ship is an oiler named after the Neosho River in central Colorado. And it just arrived and had 6 million gallons of aviation gas on board. So as the torpedoes hit the California, the Oklahoma capsized, the Arizona was burning, the West Virginia was sinking. The captain decided he was a little too close to what was going on. So he moved the ship, the Neosho, over to the submarine base over here. So as I got down to the landing there, the Neosho was just going by. Now, I knew what a quart of gasoline will do in a bottle. And you asked me what I saw and what I felt. I was resigned to the fact that the Japanese were swarming over her with machine guns, you know, like a swarm of bees. And I was sure pretty much one was going to penetrate. So I was resigned to the fact that I would never escape from the explosion of the Neosho when she went off. So for the next hour, that was what was foremost in my mind, was that the Neosho, they're going to get to her. But they didn't. They never did hit a vital spot on her. So that was never out of my mind, that pretty soon it's going to go up. Well, by the time I got aboard, we'd lost all power, so we couldn't fight back. But everything was burning above the waterline. And gunnery is my specialty, so I knew where all the ready ammunition was. It was stored topside. And as the flames was approaching us, two or three of us grabbed fire hoses from the Tennessee to cool off the ammunition so there'd be no further explosions. But when there are bodies lying around, we lost 105 in the attack. No matter how important you're doing, you can't ignore the fact. So you couldn't tell whether the person just knocked out or whether they were dead. But I tried to identify as many as I could and said, well, I'm probably the only one that can write their parents. So anybody that I saw, I tried to identify who it was and make a mental note that I'm going to write their parents and tell what happened. Well, after almost 3 hours, The attacks were over. The last planes that came were three low-flying reconnaissance planes taking pictures. So they somehow they escaped the few anti-aircraft guns that were still firing. So now they had pictures of what they wanted, why the Japanese went on back to their carriers. Well, by, I would say, 1 or 2 o'clock, we had all the fires out except the Arizona. Now, that night, there was a blackout all over Hawaii so that they couldn't be seen if the Japanese were ready to return flight. But that was kind of a satirical because the Arizona burned for 3 days, and it lit up the whole island like a volcano that went off. But everything else had blacked out except the Arizona. But I was anxious to know how many of my friends had survived and how many of them that were over the hospital. So they immediately set up an emergency burn ward over the hospital. And I went over there in the afternoon. I didn't have to ask anybody where it was because you could smell it a half mile away where they set up. So I found a few of my friends. They were probably 60 or 70 people there. Most of them were in suspension. You know, they couldn't move, and you'd hardly see their faces. But anybody that could talk, I went around and said, give me the address of your parents, and I'll write them a letter, tell them I saw you and where you are. Well, a lot of them died before they ever got the letter, but I still got some of the letters that some of the parents wrote me back after that because I knew I'd be the only one that could tell them what had happened. Now to wrap up, and then we'll have some questions if you'd like here. Spiritually, I was pretty well prepared for what was going to happen. Just a few days before, I had read a letter from a soldier, British soldier, who was in the evacuation of Dunkirk. Now, remember that between World War I and II, the French built the Maginot Line on all the border between Germany and France. They had enough supplies and ammunition for 3 years. But the Germans, when they got ready to invade France, they went through Belgium right around the Maginot Line. And all the guns were pointed the wrong way, so we couldn't get back to them there. About 350,000 went to the beach at Dunkirk, and the British started evacuating them back to England. It took about 3 days. So one of these guys was a Christian. And he said, well, you can't dodge them. So he organized a soccer tournament. And they were out there having a soccer tournament, right, while the Germans were bombing and strafing. But he said, I had the greatest peace that I've ever had in my life. He said, it was an amazing experience. I knew I was going to be in heaven in just a little bit. I looked forward to it, could hardly wait. But he did survive. Well, from the moment I first realized the danger personally, actually, no sooner got out of the car, there were about 140 Japanese fighters flying around. They had no targets. They had machine guns. So they were firing at everything that moved. So this one started approaching real low level. We looked up to it, olive drab, you know, looked like an army plane. Then all of a sudden, here was this trench of machine gun bullets right at our feet, you know. He banked a little too far. And when he banked to go away, you could see the red circle under the plane there, knew who it was, but he was so close that you could see the determination in his mind, you know. He had an open cockpit there. So from that point on, I realized there was personal danger, but I experienced that same peace. I can't describe the peace that went on during that next 2.5 hours, which seemed like about 30 minutes, not 2.5. So the lifelong lesson I've learned from it, that if there's any danger, that God supplies peace. If the danger is imaginary, then all frustrated, panic about it. So if I ever get frustrated, panicky, shook up about something, I say, hey, there's no real danger. If there was real danger, then God's response would be peace. So that's been a lot of help, man. That's the reason that I've got the blood pressure of a teenager today, 90 years old, that I don't get shook up very easily because I know if there's any real danger, it'll be accompanied by a real peace. Well, do you have any comments or any questions?
When you were on the way to the ship from the home, was I can't imagine what that was like. I mean, were there sirens going off? Was that a fast trip? I mean.
Well, yeah, it was a fast trip. But some of the sentries were very security conscious, but there happened to be a friend of ours that was at the submarine base entrance, and he was shooting with these old 30-30 rifles, the Japanese planes. He just waved everybody through. So we all got through the gate pretty speedy. Of course, a small area like that, 150 planes, they're pretty visible in there. So they were everywhere, and particularly the fighters that they had no enemy to engage. So they were just looking at anything that moved that they'd shoot at there. Yeah, Mike?
Mr. Downing, I spoke with my dad a couple days ago. He's in Pennsylvania, and he was there at Schofield Barracks. He was a soldier, about 17 years old, and he said when the attack happened, he saw two American planes, and I think this was in the movie Tora Tora, two American fighter pilots jump in their planes and go up and fight those 130 planes. He said he watched the dogfight that occurred there.
Yeah, well, if the there's a little Marine airfield called Eva, and the Japanese apparently weren't aware of it. So when the attack broke out, right here, pilots that were stationed there phoned ahead and asked them to arm their planes and, gas them up. So about six of the pilots got down there to that air station, but only two of them got off the ground. And they got credit for shooting down six Japanese planes. So if our fighter force had been alerted, apparently they were a good match for the Japanese. But these guys both got decorated, the two of them, that got their planes off the ground and actually engaged the Japanese.
Did Roosevelt know that the Japanese were coming?
Here we go.
It's a great debate.
Say that again.
Did Roosevelt know that the Japanese were coming?
Didn't have a clue. Now, people today can't imagine what it was like to be without radar and satellites. But in 1941, you only knew what you saw over the horizon. And the Army was responsible for security within 50 miles of Oahu. But as a part of making Kuruzo see that we were a peaceful nation, they called off patrol. However, the patrol only operated from sunrise to sunset. Now, you know that also the Army had a radar, but it only operated. They turned it off at sunrise. Well, a couple guys did stay out there and saw the Japanese coming. They warned their officer that was responsible for, and he said, well, we've got a flight of B-17s coming in. The thing is, the Japanese were coming from the north, and the B-17s were coming from the east. But it could have been averted if the just warning had been taken seriously. But these two guys who stayed on just because this was a big video game to them, even though they were relieved of duty at sunrise. 7:55, quite a while after sunrise,
Jim, when you got to the Tennessee, was there somebody in charge of you guys? They're fighting fire, and how did you manage to get firefighting equipment from the Tennessee over to West Virginia? I'm curious just the logistics of that.
Yeah, well, you can see in that picture that the Tennessee had all of her fire hoses going. They're keeping the fire away from their ship. So, yeah, they were, Tennessee, they were shooting and had hose and everything. So somebody just gave me their hose. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but the order had been given to abandon ship. That's the reason there wasn't anybody fighting fires on the ship. So there were about three of us that I think that went on over, paid no attention to the abandoned ship, because we knew that ammunition was topside and what would happen when the fire reached it there. Yes.
So those two aircraft that got up, the two airplanes, the fighters?
They survived and came back and landed.
Yeah.
That's when they got done.
Yeah, I think there were six that tried to take off, but a couple of them were shot before they get off the runway, and a couple others, I don't know whether they were shot in the air or not, but two of them used up all their gas up there fighting. Yeah. I think I'm accurate on that. You know, I've got the minute account here. I'd have to check the exact detail. Yeah.
Jim, did you tell about Marina making you late that
morning? Fred, can you hear him? Will you tell me?
About the part where Marina made you late?
No, he... the people that were at the main gate, the security was checking him down. But just a few hundred yards was a submarine base gate. Of course, he was really alert. You know, he just opened the gate wide open, waved everybody in. And
when your wife kept you late, you were late getting to the Virginia, weren't you, that morning?
Well, I would say that in the minute we heard the explosions, we knew something's going on, so we got dressed. We were in civilian clothes. We got in our uniforms. We were underway within probably 5 or 10 minutes from the house on the way to the harbor. Actually, I don't know if anybody watched it yesterday or not, but Channel 5 and 30 was out 6 o'clock taking pictures Thursday morning, and they had a couple of segments on that. And so they asked what it was like when we separated. Well, she gave me a verse of Scripture. And I gave her the verse back, Deuteronomy 33:27, the eternal God is our refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. So we never knew when we'd see each other again, but those are the verses we left with. So she didn't make me late, no.
I was going to say, two footnotes. One night, September 11th, I went upstairs to see what was going on. They brought the TV set into the office, and they showed New York City and the towers, and everything was up in smoke, and it looked just like Battleship Row. I couldn't forget the parallel there. I mean, it was like just a row of buildings on fire. The other footnote, the gentleman that led the attack on Pearl Harbor, Mitsuo Fuchida, became a believer. He's the one who said, Torah, Torah, Torah. Yeah. And there's a wonderful book called God's Samurai by Gordon Prang that tells the story. He could not understand how a Christian could be forgiven. And I think that's the best part of the story. And he was amazed that they were able to do what they were able to do. That
yeah, here's his story right here. In fact, I met him and talked to him several times after the attack. After he became a Christian, he signed up with a Chicago policeman. They started a youth organization. So he stayed at Glen Eyrie when he came through town, you know, probably 3 or 4 times. I know he stayed overnight there after the war. I first met him in Pearl Harbor at a Christian gathering, and he wanted to lay a wreath on the Arizona. You know, felt the remorse for what he had done. But the island of Oahu is 90% Japanese. And when they found out he was in town, they wanted to tar and feather him. You know, he had to get a bodyguard once they found out he was there, Christian or no Christian.
Jim, do you remember when Doolittle Raiders, when they flew over, where were you at that point?
Well, I was the... a postmaster on the ship, in addition to my other duties. And I was signed up for thousands and thousands of dollars, and I was bonded. So they wouldn't let me be transferred to another ship until I'd accounted for everything I lost that morning. So I was assigned a salvage crew. So it took approximately a year to get the ship repaired and raise it and get her back in commission again. So I lived in civilian housing just right off the ship, off Ford Island. And that's where it was in the Doolittle Raiders. But that's the nearest to a psychic experience that I've ever had, that I knew probably 75 or 80 guys that were in the raid. And the night before, I just felt like, you know, well, the next thing we need to do is raid Japan. So I think all these guys, you know, were awake. They're praying for me, a lot of them, you know. So I kind of entered into that. Then the next morning I saw the newspaper that Doolittle Raiders had made the attack. Now, the connection between Fuchida, who led the raid, and the Doolittle Raiders is very interesting. One of the guys that was shot down over China became a POW. after the war, he went to Bible school, went back to be a missionary in Japan. So Fushida was writing a book called No More Pearl Harbor. But he didn't know where you'd get the moral power to overcome the primitive instincts. So MacArthur sent for him to come in for a consultation. And an American missionary gave him a tract. And the tract was the account of this shot down serviceman. And while he was in prison camp, he was given a Bible. And as a result of the Bible, he became a Christian. So Fushida said, well, if it's the Bible that changed his life, I'll get a Bible. And so as a result of that, he got a Bible and became a Christian as a result of that. That was his conversion. Yes, sir.
You said that you manned the guns. Did you get a chance to fire any of the aircraft or anything?
No, our ship was, we lost all power. Now, there were a few shots for manually, but they didn't amount to much because the whole armor on the ship depends on power except for machine guns. And, of course, if you've read the stories you read about Doris Miller, the steward that manned a machine gun up there got a Medal of Honor as a result of it. So machine guns, we had 50 caliber machine guns, but they didn't require any power. But all of our other aircraft required electrical power. Yeah.
But you said you slid down a gun to get to your ship, and you fought a fire. How long were you on the ship, and how in the heck did you get off a sunk ship?
How did I get off?
Well, I mean, how long were you on the ship, and what was that process? I had heard you had given your watch to somebody while you were knee-deep in fuel oil. And
yeah.
Like that. What happened while you were on the ship?
Yeah, well, that's amazing that... After a while, after fighting fires and handling bodies and so forth, I realized I was kind of hungry. So I had a friend that was on the Tennessee right next to me. By the way, right in the height of the attack, I was knee-deep in fuel oil, and I gave him my watch and asked him to keep it for me after the battle was over. So I looked him up, and I said, do you know anybody up in the galley that might give me a sandwich? So he said, yeah, he took me up the galley. And while they were making a sandwich, I noticed the clock, and it was 11:45. Now, if you'd asked me what time it was, I'd have said about 9:15, because everything happened so fast. So I just don't know. Those two things I remember was trying to keep the ammunition going off, and then every time... Your eye falls on a body, you're not sure whether he's alive or dead, you know, while you try to do something about that. But I've never had time compressed like that in my whole life.
So did you get back to the Tennessee then? Or?
Yeah, I probably went ashore off the Tennessee. But at that time, there were boats coming alongside picking up the rest of the wounded and the dead on there. So that was the highest priority, was to get all the bodies off. Now, the 105 that we lost, 70 were below decks, so they weren't rescued until we didn't find them, so we raised the ship. But there were a lot of laying around on decks there.
How long before you saw Marina again?
The next morning, she came down. She had an identification card. I wasn't sure they'd let her in, but she did. And I was covered with fuel oil on my hair and every place else. But we had a good reunion there. I'm sure I didn't get too close to her. But another friend and I, we used the same toothbrush for the rest of that week. There we found a toothbrush someplace.
Jim, you were involved in Bible studies with a number of these men, weren't you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that was difficult.
Yeah, well, we had about 110 guys that were involved in some kind of Bible study, and about a tenth of them, were among the casualties.
Jim, after the attack, was there some opportunity to witness, to share, that people want to receive the Lord?
Well,
they were probably pretty open.
What happens is, in my experience, and there's other of you that are veterans, that... during combat, Smitty, you know this too, that the serviceman has a real keen consciousness of when there's danger and when there isn't danger. But once the danger's passed, then they change in a hurry. And I'll just give you one example that I suppose it was probably just after the second wave came in that one of the fellows on the ship that I had witnessed to came up, and he said, "Deacon," he said, "I got something I got to tell you." He said, "I was blown over the side and ran out of breath trying to swim ashore." He had to push the oil ahead of him. And he said, "I knew it was those cigarettes." And he said, "I told God that if you'd just give me enough breath to get ashore, I'll never smoke again." So that was his testimony he gave me. And I looked down his arm. "What's that between your fingers?" He had a cigarette. And he wasn't even conscious of it. So you can see how long his resolve lasted. But probably the things, one of the things I remember at best was the next morning. You know, that a lot of money, you know, probably millions of dollars that the dispersing officer had in his safe there. So the ship was down in the water, you know, about 10 or 12 feet. But he got some people up with a cutting torch, and they welded a pad eye on the safe and hoisted it out. He took it over shore and turned his money in. Well, then he set up an emergency pay. You know, all of our records were lost. So he had us make out a sworn statement of the last time we'd been paid, and then he began to pay up from that point because nobody had any money on them. Well, he was a good friend of mine because I used to see him every day in connection with my duties. So I walked in his office, Ensign Fowler, his name. And he got up, came up to me, and turned pale and began to breathe hard. And he ran his arms, my hands up and down my shoulders, my arms. And with a short breath, he said, am I ever glad to see you? And I said, "Well, I'm glad to see you too. But then we never had a ceremony like this before." And he said, "Do you know who walked out of here just before you came in?" I said, "Well, I'm sorry, no, I didn't notice." He says, "The chaplain. He told me that he had just buried you." So you know how the people felt after the resurrection. You know, well, actually there was another man with the same last name as mine that the chaplain had buried, but he just gave me his last name. So he saw somebody back from the dead. And, of course, I had the same experience, too, that one of the things you do after the battle's over is you check on your friends, you know. So, well, do you know if he survived? He survived. You ask everybody, have you seen him? So we ask about a barber on the ship, and they said no. One of the guys said, "I laid him out on Fort Island." Well, the next day when I was in a food line, I saw it looked like the back of his head, and I went around the front, and sure enough, it was this guy that had been reported dead. Well, what happened to a concussion? The bombs knock a lot of people out. When you see them laying down, you don't know whether they're dead or alive. Well, they laid out a whole row on Fort Island, 15 or 20. And by mid-afternoon, they got up and wandered away, you know, got their conscience back again. So he was one of those guys. So I know what it feels, how to look in the eye of somebody that somebody told you is dead on that.
You know, Jim, you talked about this peace in the midst of immense danger. I mean, That intrigues me. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, I had one other experience similar to that. That we were coming out of New York Harbor in a fog, and I was the officer of the deck, and a radar picked up this big ship coming on a collision course about a mile away. And the captain did everything he was supposed to do, but it didn't avoid the collision. And I told him, I said, "We're going to get hit because the radar shows we're on a collision course." He said, "Well, what would you do?" I said, "Well, the water's only 18 feet deep out there, and we can get out of the channel and still not hit the ground. But he can't. He's bigger than we are." So that's what I'd do. No. So when he broke the fog, I made sure the quartermaster made a note of what's happened, sounded the collision alarm. And we were in a bridge, had a ceiling about like this. And I remember stepping out on the bridge because I didn't want to hit my head on the way up when the explosion went off. Well, the tanker hit us, and it turned red hot when steel goes into steel. You know, it turns red hot. but it didn't spread into the tanks. We had a 500,000 gallons of gas on there. I was disappointed and let down because I just knew that within minutes, you know, I was going to be in heaven. So that went on for an hour and a half, you know, because I was sure the negotio was going to go up. And I think lots of people had that experience, you know, when you're just on the brink, why God gives that wonderful peace.
Jim, would you tell everybody the Bikini Atoll story you told me? You made my hair stand on end.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one of the other experiences that I had was that I was a captain of a ship by that time, and we had a mission out to Bikini and Inuitok. The people running the H-bomb explosion in 53, it was a civilian operation. AEC ran it, and they didn't cut the military in too much on what was going on, except those involved. So we were within about 200 miles when the H-bomb went off. And we were so badly contaminated that you know, we had to give a gallon of urine when we got in. All of our white blood cells went way down. And we had to live in that for a while to see if it was going to recover. So that was another experience, you know. Didn't know whether to make it because the fatal dosage or the allowable dosage of radiation at that time was 0.625. And we were saturated with 20 Rankins, which was more than 20 times the allowable dose. But we recovered from that. But
you told me that somebody on deck said, "What was that bright light 100 miles behind us?" And you were ordered out at top speed, and you only could go 20 knots or something?
Yeah. Well, what happened after we got in port, my operations officer sent for me, and he said, "We have word from the Atomic Energy Commission that you may have been contaminated." He said, "What would make them think that?" And I said, "Well, Commander, if you saw the sun come up in the west instead of the east, what would you think?" And he said, "I think we'd better not talk on an insecure telephone." He said, "Come on over to my office." So I did. But yeah, that was living with that stuff for a week, you know. And of course, when we got ashore, our friends wouldn't come within 20 feet of us.
Jim, you said that you knew about 80 of the people that were on the Doolittle raid. How did you meet them since they were in the Army Air Corps and you were in the Navy?
Well, the on the Doolittle raid, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, on the ship's crews. I didn't know any of the pilots, you know. They only had, I think, 16 planes. But there was a whole task force there, you know, of several thousand, and many of them were my friends in the fleet there. And I just figured, you know, a lot of them were probably praying for me that night. They were awake. And somehow there was kind of a communication that I knew something was going on. That's the nearest to one of those extra whatever experience you call it. Yes?
Yeah, I'm from Pearl City.
Uh-huh.
It's my hometown.
Yeah.
And you said you were eating 20 minutes away from Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
Where exactly was that?
We lived up the Cam Highway. Just on the edge of Honolulu, you know, between Honolulu, yeah. And, well, I have to tell you a story about Pearl City since you brought that up. A lot of the guys that were blown off swam ashore, didn't know what was going on, so they ended up in the cane fields out in Pearl City there. Well, mosquitoes are pretty bad there, you know, so the next morning the mosquitoes were pretty bad out there, and they were kind of hungry. So they began to show up. In the meantime, the receiving station there at Pearl Harbor was taking the people whose ships were sunk. So the Navy had just gone on IBM and had a pretty accurate personnel system. So these guys began to show up looking for something to eat. Well, there was a chief that had kind of a little headquarters there. And when he'd see them come up, he said, "You cowards, your parents have probably already been notified that you're dead. And here you show up." He said, "You're a disgrace to the Navy." You know, he gave him quite a dressing down. So the next two or three mornings, all the people who died at the hospital were put in ambulances and sent out to Red Hill to be buried. And they had a mass military ceremony with a firing squad. So one of these guys that came in from Pearl City asked the chief, he says, well, I didn't know it was that bad. What do you think it'll do to us? He said, I don't know, but if I had my way, I'd shoot you. And about that time, the ambulances came up. And so somebody told the chief that, the ambulance arrived. And he said, well, pass the word for the firing squad. Well, these guys didn't know what had gone on behind the back. And they were really shook up.
Downey, the way you described it, or you seem to describe it, was that because you and some of the other men got on to West Virginia and began hosing down the ammunition, you were able, is that what was able to keep the West Virginia from blowing up the magazine and so forth?
Well, all the main magazines were underwater, but each gun had maybe 50 rounds of what they call ready ammunition. It was in a locker right there up top side. So that people wouldn't know about that, weren't in gunnery, but that was my concern, that that stuff could damage the people on the Tennessee. I think I wasn't concerned as much about, blowing up on the ship, which was in pretty bad shape, but then it'd be a tremendous explosion if those things went off.
Jim, we weren't very well prepared for December 7th, but after it happened, we reacted appropriately. We weren't very prepared for September 11th, 2001. Are you satisfied with the reaction that we've had since then in helping to prevent another terrorist attack with all that's been done?
Well, I think everything that can be done is being done to prevent a terrorist attack, but then that's not combat, that's sabotage. You know, and it'll never accomplish anything except being a nuisance to a lot of people, but militarily it won't accomplish much, so I don't think it's that serious. But it's sure disturbing. But I'm often asked, how do you compare the attack on Pearl Harbor with 9/11? And I say, well, 9/11, I think, was a real catastrophe, but this was not a military situation. We were never in any danger militarily. So there's no comparison between the two. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, it was kind of a precarious situation militarily for a while there.
Jim, why didn't they finish us off? Why didn't they invade? The fleets destroyed, the air arms destroyed, we're wide open. They can come in and just waste us, take the island over. Why didn't they do it?
Yeah, well, I asked Fushida that. And his mission was to neutralize the battleships because they had their eye on the Philippines. They weren't thinking about Hawaii. The Philippines, you know, that was the whole thing. So once the battleships were neutralized, they could get on with the invasion of the Philippines. On some of these pictures, you see, they never touched the Navy Yard, sub base, and there were two giant tank farms there, and the Neosho that I mentioned, you know. There are all kinds of targets that would have been much more strategic than the battleships, but that was the reason they came. Now, the second thing is that they only had a four-hour window between refueling. So they had sent their tankers home and were to meet the next group of tankers to refuel the task force. They only had a four-hour window. So they weren't prepared to make a second attack or follow up because they'd run out of fuel if they had. But Fushida told me that once he had the pictures to show that the battleship has been neutralized, mission accomplished, went home. Now, you know as a historian that after what was an apparently a great success at Pearl Harbor, Admiral Yamamoto advanced the timetable for invading the U.S. 50 years. He put together everything that would float to attack Midway with the idea of using Midway as a base to capture the Hawaiian Islands, set up a base there from which they would attack the West Coast. So he came to Midway with everything that would float almost. But you remember in the reversal of Midway. So they lost all their carriers, battleship, cruiser. And so they reverted back to their old timetable. So their strategy in World War II was to fortify what they call the Southern Resources Area so strong that they'd get to keep it in the peace terms. So their objective after Midway was simply to retain the Southern Resources Area. They fought a defensive war from after Midway.
I've heard this before, that like the Japanese hid behind the horizon. What is that distance that, you know, like when you're out on the ocean and you can hide on the other side of the horizon? What is the distance of the horizon?
Yeah, well, you know what, see, you can figure it out that the curvature of Earth is about 6 inches a mile. So when you're out at sea, if another ship is out there, the first thing you see is the top of their mast. So they don't have to be more than 20 miles away till they're over the curve to where you can't see them. So as the ship comes over the horizon, you know, it gets bigger and bigger, but the first thing you see is the mast. Now, we had scouting planes aboard ship that we could, when the weather was favorable, we'd put up to find out what's going on around us. But my first job on the ship was up in the top of the tower, you know, with glasses looking over the horizon, because from the highest point on the ship, you can see a lot further out there.
Kind of like what I do when I want to see it past the horizon. I go on that little 14,000-foot pile of dirt.
Yeah, well, it's nothing like it on land. You can't detect the curvature of the Earth. But at sea, it's very, very, you know, you see ships over the horizon. Of course, in Columbus's day, they thought they sailed off the edge when they went over there. Well, you've been a good audience here. And Matt and I, thank you very much for coming. I haven't noticed the clock. I don't know what time it is. I think I should mention that the battleship West Virginia has a good website, and they have the stories of quite a few people on there, including mine. My story in much more detail is on that website. And the name of the website is just USSWestVirginia.org, all one word. And then it's got both prefixes, HTTP and www, then USSWestVirginia.org, along with some good pictures and statements of a lot of people that were aboard that morning there. Mm-hmm.